Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome back to the show. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. My wife says I yell all the time. You don't know how loud you are, she says. And I think maybe I'm going deaf from these darn headphones. I'm gonna turn those things down a little bit. I got Will Grigg on the line. I hit the wrong button. I got Will Grigg on the line. He's at Pro Libertate. freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and he is the author of the book Liberty in Eclipse, which you can also get on audiobook at listenandthinkaudio.com. And I keep forgetting all show long to mention today that I'm attempting to continue my fund drive, and I even have someone offering matching funds if people will if I can get 10 people to donate $50, he will match it up to $500. So that would be really, really nice. If anybody wants to stop by scotthorton.org/donate. And introducing Will Grigg is a good time for me to remember that I need to ask you that, because I'd also like to ask you to donate to Will Grigg's efforts, too. He is among the very, very, very best opponents of America's warfare state and militarism and local police abuse that we have. He's an extremely important part of the libertarian movement. We absolutely have to keep him writing and commentating on the police state in America, you know, so we can be a little bit more free. That's why. It's freedominourtime.blogspot.com, and right there on the right side, there's a button to donate by PayPal to Will Grigg's efforts as well. So thank you very much for doing that. I would appreciate it. And now thank you, Will, for joining us on the show today. How are you?
That was a generous and gracious gesture. Thank you so much. That means a lot to me.
Well, you deserve a hell of a lot more than I do, so there you go. I got to do something.
I wouldn't necessarily agree with that assessment, but thank you so much.
All right. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Making murder reasonable. How the Ferguson PD will whitewash the killing of Michael E. Brown. Do tell, sir.
The thing that's happening now, I'm convinced, is that Officer Darren Wilson and the people advising him, which would include at least one police union rep and a lawyer and a number of people within the risk management community there in Ferguson, we haven't been told specifically, but according to standard protocol, this is what's going to happen, is that they're going to try to present this as a matter of a reasonable officer in an evolving situation confronting an imminent threat to his life. And under Chapter 563 of the Missouri Revised Statutes, they're going to say that whether or not Brown was a felony suspect, something that Wilson did not know at the time, according to the tardy disclosure and the reluctant disclosure by Chief Jackson, in spite of the fact that he was unarmed and had fled, that he turned to face the officer and in doing so signaled that he was resuming whatever conflict had ensued before he had fled, and that created within the mind of Officer Wilson the reasonable fear that he confronted an imminent threat to his life, and so he shot him several times in spite of the fact that numerous witnesses, not merely Dorian Johnson, but also a very articulate young woman by the name of Piaget Crenshaw, who had no connection to anything that Brown had been doing earlier, in spite of the fact that witnesses say that his hands were up and he was in a posture of surrender, the case is going to be made that this was a ruse and that he was still an antagonist and that it is an act of justifiable homicide for a police officer in that situation to shoot him several times and kill him. That's the case that's going to be made. And it's going to be subsumed under what's called the reasonable officer standard pursuant to Garner versus Tennessee. And Garner versus Tennessee was handed down by the Supreme Court in 1985. It was on the basis of an 11-year-old case involving a fleeing suspect in a burglary, a home robbery. The suspect did not surrender. He did not submit to arrest. He was fleeing from the police officer who shot him. He wasn't armed at the time, was another teenager. And in that case, the Supreme Court said that not every use of force against a fleeing suspect is constitutionally reasonable. If you're dealing with an unarmed suspect who doesn't pose an immediate threat, to the life or physical safety of a police officer or somebody else in the public, then that shot is an unconstitutional taking. And what they're going to try to say, given the fact that Missouri has a very low threshold of justification for official homicide by a police officer, what they're going to say is that what matters here is the subjective impression of Officer Wilson, that he had struggled with Brown, and of course there are eyewitnesses that confirm that a struggle of some sort took place. Wilson's trying to say that the first gunshot happened because Brown had reached in and tried to disarm him. If he was shot during that engagement, and I'm not sure whether or not that point's been nailed down flush, if he was shot during that engagement, it's difficult to see how he would have absorbed a bullet wound to his right side when, from what we understand, Officer Wilson was right-handed, and I don't see how the struggle could have evolved in such a way to where he would have been shot at that point while reaching for the officer's gun. But what they're going to try to say is that what matters is the perception of the police officer in this situation, and that even if there's some ambiguity regarding the ballistics or the autopsy results or contradictory testimony, in the absence of a dash cam, the Ferguson Police Department has them. It's just not gotten around to installing them because officer accountability is not one of its institutional priorities. In the absence of that dash cam video, and despite all the contradictions and ambiguities, the dispositive fact is that the officer feared for his life. And on that basis, they're almost certainly going to find that the shooting was justified, and that there will not be criminal charges pressed within that jurisdiction against Officer Wilson. It's possible that the federal government might get involved in filing a federal civil rights charge against him. Mm-hmm. And the federal role so far in this whole episode has not been that of dispensing healing balm on a troubled community. This is the same federal government that up-armored the Ferguson PD to ridiculous levels, that provided not only with the weaponry, but the training that unleashed a literal counterinsurgency warfare operation on the streets of Ferguson last week. And you've got the FBI now supervising the investigation by the Missouri Highway Patrol. The FBI, of course, are the people who give us such marvels of investigative virtuosity as the crime lab, the National Crime Lab, which, of course, is scandal-ridden and completely unreliable. And they have inflicted themselves on previous situations such as Mount Carmel in Texas and Ruby Ridge here in Idaho, and the result is not really conducive to the welfare of the people involved or to the tranquility of the community thus affected. So as far as I can tell, what's likely to happen is that you're going to see the official exoneration of Wilson, and you're going to see another eruption in Ferguson, and you're going to see concomitant eruptions most likely in other cities where people have had a surfeit of official impunity and police abuse, and things will probably get nastier from there. That's, in any case, the way I see things unfolding in the near future.
Yeah. All right, well, so there's a lot to go back over there and a lot more to address as well. But it seems to me, Will, that the protest basically is awaiting the indictment. That's what they're saying, more or less, is we're not going back inside until we hear that this cop has been indicted. And so, you know, when he's not indicted, then I don't know what they think they're going to do. And it's already been the case where I'm sure they weren't listening to me, but they took my exact advice after a 3 or 4 day delay there, and they withdrew the local sheriff's department and city police and called in the state highway patrol in slacks and shirts with handguns and pistols and not rifles and not body armor and SWAT gear and all that stuff. But then that hasn't lasted because, well, again, the people aren't going inside until this man is indicted. And so when the cops say, all right, now everybody disperse, and they don't, the cops, all of a sudden, they're just mouse-a-tongue, barrel of the gun. That's all they know. That's where their power comes from. And so then even the highway patrol now is up-armoring itself for taking on these protesters, gassing them, attacking them. And now the governor's called out the National Guard under, I think, the assumption that somehow this is going to calm everything down, with or without an indictment of the shooter in this case. And so, you know, I don't know how bad things could get, Will, but it sounds like they're just setting everything up for a disaster here.
Well, one of the things that we have
to now the music's playing. I'm sorry, Will. I always do that. Talk us right up to the break. Hold it right there. We got to take this break, and then we'll be right back and talk more about Ferguson with the great Will Grigg. Again, the website is freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Freedom in Our Time. blogspot.com and donate there on the right side of the page too. Thanks. We'll be right back. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all, QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with the great Will Grigg, author of Liberty in Eclipse. And the great blog, Pro Libertate, at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And Will, during the break, I saw on Twitter, and now I got it on the news here, a partial answer to my question. The Missouri governor has called off the Ferguson curfew.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit of a de-escalation there compared to how I set up that question. But anyway, I was asking you to speculate as to the future, considering the mindset, the policy, and the equipment of those so-called authorities in charge there.
I'm not sure who is in operational command there in Ferguson, because the highway state, the state patrol, the highway patrol captain, Ron Johnson, who is with great fanfare installed as the more palliative figure in charge of the investigation and overall command at the scene, doesn't appear to be in control of the tactical situation. There was last night, of course, a curfew violation that resulted in another very lurid crackdown against the protests. And before the curfew began, there was actually a tear gas assault that was captured by some of the media. And some of the media who were embedded, I guess would be the correct expression, with the riot police were actually being attacked or shoved away from the site before curfew actually descended. The other thing that I think is significant part of the story, and this is, I think, a lesson that we should extract from this, is that nothing that has been done by the riot police has been to the benefit of the property owners who are actually suffering from the violence of looters and pillagers. Mm-hmm. There have been several accounts, some of them on camera, one of them, interestingly enough, on National Review Online, which is not notable for its criticism of the police, several accounts in which local business owners have said that they had desperately entreated the police to come and help them when they were under siege by looters, only to be told that that's no longer the job of the police, as if it were to begin with. Police do not exist for the purpose of protecting private property. Some of them do this. This is incidental to their primary task, which is to enforce the will of the political class and to extract revenue for their benefit. And in this case, the only thing that they're worried about right now is essentially suppressing protests, not dealing with threats to private property. And it's worth pointing out that in a moral sense, if not in an operational sense, that the people who are throwing Molotov cocktails at businesses and stealing from business owners are on the same side as the people who are heaving CS canisters into private property, into yards, and into homes in the interest, supposedly, of imposing order. They're both on the side opposed to private property rights. And the latter, of course, we're talking about the police in that instance, the latter are using the former basically as a rationale for doing what every government everywhere wants to do all the time, which is to impose order at the expense of liberty. And I do think that it's welcome to see Governor Nixon backing off the brink a little bit here by removing the curfew. But there have been oscillations before over the last several days where there's been, as you pointed out, Scott, a less confrontational approach, and it lasted just long enough for events to overtake it and to redefine the tactical situation. And I don't know who's driving those events. I don't know if we're dealing here with people who have simply flocked to Ferguson, opportunistically exploiting the tumult. People, there are people who meet that description, of course. There are people who literally live for the purpose of dispelling civility wherever it rears its head, and so people of that sort, of course, would find Ferguson an attractive destination right now. We do know that the so-called Community Relations Service of the Justice Department has been on the ground, and knowing what they've been doing elsewhere, it's a very rational suspicion, I believe, that they might be liaising with some of the worst elements on the ground. For instance, this tribute band that calls itself the New Black Panther Party has been on the ground talking with people both in the Highway Patrol and I think with the CRS. And these are the people who are leading a death chant against Officer Wilson, you know, that they want him dead. And that's certainly something that's not going to conduce toward amity or toward a relief of the tensions there.
Somebody needs to put their leader's FBI file on WikiLeaks right now.
Yes, exactly.
Give me a break, man.
Yeah, he's a
spitzel. Oh, I can see right through you. Look at that, huh?
Yeah, exactly. he's just as big of a spitzel, just as big as Stukach, to use the German and Russian words respectively for informant, as Al Sharpton. And last week when Sharpton materialized in Ferguson, it was interesting to see the reaction he provoked. There were a lot of people telling him to get the hell out because he's a snitch. He doesn't have any credibility with the people who were there to protest what they perceived to be an injustice that is part of a long train of abuses that they have suffered. So I think that was a healthy development as far as it went. But you still have this fellow from the so-called New Black Panther Party down there evangelizing supposedly on behalf of radicalism and probably acting in the service of the people who've been slopping his trough now for a number of years, namely the Feds.
Yeah. There's probably only like a 98 or 99% chance of that, Will.
I don't know. Don't overstate it or anything.
Come on. Now, wait, let me go back to a detail about the killing of Mike Brown in the first place here. I wanted to ask you, if you knew, if you'd read or heard anything from the autopsy reports about whether there was any sign of an arm around his throat, because I believe, and I'm sorry, I don't know my footnotes here. You could confirm whether this is even anybody's version of the story at this point or not, Will, I'm sure, that the cop had grabbed him around the throat from inside the police truck. It was like a SUV type police car there.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I just wonder whether the doctors had mentioned that, there was some bruising there or not, or did anybody ask them? Is that in the report?
Dr. Baden has said this morning, he's the one who performed the first autopsy there yesterday, he said that there's no signs of a physical struggle between the two of them, and that he'd need to examine the clothing of Officer Wilson and also the clothing that was worn by Brown at the time of the event to develop a fuller understanding of what may have happened there. Mm-hmm. And so he didn't make any mention of an injury to the throat or other physical trauma that would suggest that he had been taken into a stranglehold. And the eyewitness accounts are ambiguous on that point. There are several people who have testified that a struggle of some sort took place. The witness I quoted earlier, Piaget Crenshaw, said that it appeared that they had been wrestling, they'd been struggling back and forth between the two of them through the open window of that SUV. I think that at one point Dorian Johnson made a comment to the effect that Officer Wilson had taken Brown by the throat. I don't know whether he's reiterated that or whether he's underscored that. He's given a number of interviews, and I've not read or seen all of them. But there are several accounts saying that there was a struggle of some sort taking place. It's pretty clear on the basis of what Chief Jackson was compelled to say by way of clarification after he had identified Officer Wilson following a very long and agonized silence on that subject. He, of course, released without comment very coyly this package of information containing a report and still photos showing a figure who appears to be Brown involved in a strong-arm robbery, thereby leaving the impression that Brown might have been investigated by Officer Wilson as a suspect in that strong-arm robbery. He was forced to admit that at the time of the encounter, Wilson had no idea of the robbery and was not looking for Brown as a suspect, but rather was approaching him as a jaywalker. And so the question has to do, from the perspective of the police, with the mindset of Brown, and that's, of course, a subject to which we no longer have access, given that he's dead. But they're trying to say that if he was approached by a cop after committing a strong-arm robbery, then he might have tried to disarm the cop in order to avoid arrest, which strikes me as counterintuitive, quite frankly. If you're being told that you're jaywalking, you want to make yourself inconspicuous. And other people have said that part of the thug culture in which Brown was supposedly raised, and that's, of course, making some rather extravagant assumptions about we know about this kid, that in the thug culture that he would have been froggy and he would have felt full of himself after beating up a much smaller man who was very bravely defending his business against a strong-arm robber. That's something that we have to acknowledge, that he would have seen it as appropriate and necessary to confront the police officer rather than backing down. I don't know how to assess that because I don't know a whole lot about Brown or about that aspect of his background. There's an effort, by the way, to confuse this Michael Brown with another Michael Brown of roughly the same age, who lives about 50 miles away in a different town in Missouri, and who, unlike the late Michael Brown, actually has a very long rap sheet that includes, among other things, violent theft and a couple of other serious crimes. A lot of people are trying to say that's the same person. The prosecutors made it clear after Brown was shot, this Michael Brown, that he had no previous criminal record. There are in circulation some recordings of supposed rap songs that he had allegedly recorded that talk about the thug life, and it could be a different Michael Brown. It could be the same Michael Brown simply giving voice to adolescent fantasies. Who knows? The point is, at the time of the encounter, the officer was not looking at him as a suspect in a strong-arm robbery. And even if he were pursuing an accused felon, a suspected felon, if that felon flees and he's unarmed, under the current standard, as articulated by the Supreme Court, the cop would not be in the right in shooting at a fleeing suspect, even a felony suspect, who is unarmed. Under Missouri law, if the suspect turned and attacked the police officer, that might be justifiable. However, the eyewitness account of Ms. Crenshaw, which was given immediately after the shooting, held that Brown turned and then held his hands up to surrender, and he was shot twice in the head. And that would seem to comport with what we heard about the autopsy findings conducted by Dr. Baden yesterday, that he was shot twice in the head, once in the top of the head and then in his right arm several times. That would be compatible with the eyewitness account of Ms. Crenshaw.
So, Will, let me ask you one more question here then about the politics. You mentioned something positive there about National Review Online actually paying attention to this from a more libertarian view than we might expect from them. And I'm not sure if you noticed, but there was actually an article at National Review Online. Basically, I forget the exact title of it or whatever, but the thrust was that it's not conservative to stick up for cops anymore the way they're acting, basically. Yeah. The Bill of Rights and freedom and the rule of law and the Constitution, these things are conservatives. And the modern police as a government program, the way they are now and as unaccountable as they are and as violent as they are now, enough is enough of this for poor black Americans and for everybody else too. And in other words, it was the best kind of thing that could have possibly ever, ever, ever been published in the National Review about that kind of thing. And I was wondering if you could comment about, you know, the possibility. I don't mean to overstate it, and I'm not really trying to ask you to overstate it really either, but I wonder what you really think, if you could assess for us the possibility that we could really see a national consensus on this, where we got civil rights and PC left-wingers all locked up, even in Obama years. Still, this is not okay at all to the left, as broadly as you could possibly define it. Of course, us libertarians are absolutely perfect on it. And then even the right-wingers now are coming together, and not just the populist, you know, militia, patriot right or whatever, but actual National Review right-wingers. Is it possible that the people of America could really have a consensus on this and speak with one voice enough on this to really see some rollback in Washington, D.C. and in our state capitals, and to demilitarize the police and maybe even, you know, work on really ending the war on drugs, Will?
I think that the one unambiguously hopeful thing that is a product of this huge and still unfolding tragedy is the fact that you have many people in the institutional conservative movement finally addressing the issue of the militarization of local police and federal control of local police, and speaking about the imperative necessity of rolling this back. And I do think that's healthy. The only thing perhaps that could undermine progress in this direction is if we actually end up having what happened in Ferguson propagate itself throughout a number of other very highly policed urban areas, and that would allow a different narrative to gain traction, which is the idea that there's a uniquely pathological urban culture that justifies, in some sense, extraordinary measures in a limited geographic way to contain the damage. And I can see where there's already being some pushback on that front. Just this morning on Fox News, you had a panel discussion that involved Bo Deedle from the NYPD and a former police commissioner, and then our good friend Bernie Kerik, who was supposed to be the first commissar of the Department of Homeland Security. And they all agreed that what happened last week in terms of the overwhelming show of force by the militarized riot police in Ferguson was entirely appropriate And their only criticism was for Captain Johnson from the Highway Patrol, that he was far too accommodating in actually addressing the grievances of the community there that they were policing. So there's already a counter, if you will, already something of a counter-revolution underway going on in the institutional right. So while there's reason for optimism, there's also an awful lot of inertia here. And right now there are efforts being made behind the scenes, I suppose, to try to find some way of repackaging this message to where it's perfectly all right to have a limited deployment of police on a wartime footing where they're really needed. But for the most part, if you're living in rural America, or you're living someplace where Fox News is the most popular cable outlet, you know, that is to say most places where the demographic is old and very white, then it'd just be a horrible thing to see that type of policing happen in those types of communities. So they're going to find some way to shoehorn this into the standard who-whom dichotomy, I think.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, people are on the sunlit side of 50 or who aren't shackled in stale ideological categories, whether you're talking about conservatives or progressives or libertarians, we're talking to each other. And so the future, I think, belongs to that faction. But in the meantime, we've got an awful lot of resistance to overcome on the part of people who are still residually authoritarian in their outlook.
Yeah. Well, and that's more and more people all the time when you break down the demographics of who's working for the state and on like that nowadays. As Ron Paul always says, how many tens of thousands of even federal agents are armed?
Exactly,
and then multiply that by a million or something for all of the local cops in the land. That's a hell of a lot of union jobs. That's a lot of patronage. Yep. That's a lot of
the very formidable iron triangle you're describing there.
Yeah, crony American system politics, right? That's what Henry Clay called it. That's what I call it too. Hey, listen, we're way over time, and I know you got to go, but thank you so much for your time, Will. You're great on this stuff, man.
Appreciate it. God bless you, Scott. It's great to talk to you.
Good to have you. That's the great Will Grigg, everybody. Liberty in Eclipse is the book, and the blog is Pro Libertate, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.